Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg has faced 10 hours of questioning on Capitol Hill over the past 2 days. The testimony was primarily about the issue of user data and privacy. Privacy has long been a fundamental tenet of American life. We have asked Nathan Connolly and Brian Ballow to tell us how. They are historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Welcome back to you both. And first off, Brian, let's start off with you, pointing out that despite the glaring light on Facebook, there are a lot of threats to privacy out there, online and off. So what draws your attention?
Well, I think virtually all the big digital companies are into the business of sharing data. What comes to my mind is a story about a father walking into a big box store, and he was really livid. He said, "Why are you sending these coupons to my daughter about baby clothes and cribs and diapers? She's just in high school." And the manager was taken aback. He apologized, and he called the father a few days later to follow up and apologize again. And the father said, "I think I owe you an apology." It turns out that my daughter's pregnant.
So it's hard to imagine what it was like way back when and how our privacy rights became ingrained in the Bill of Rights and this idea of protecting people as private citizens, as individuals. How, Nathan, did it rise to that level? Where was it recognized as and when was it recognized as a right at all?
Well, if you think back to the colonial household, right, it was much harder to, say, hide a pregnancy from one's father if you didn't even have separate bedrooms, right? So the colonial period was one of very intimate family quarters. You know, our modern notions of privacy almost didn't really apply to this period. But in terms of the country's political and social landscape, there were a lot of things that were happening in terms of relationships between the people living in North America and the British Crown, for instance. And so very basic things at the time, people being concerned about, say, one's mail being open. That was an issue of legislation. You actually had to have an act passed in 1710 to issue some kind of punishment for folks who were entering other people's mail. But as you move closer to the late 18th and early 19th century, you know, there's going to be a very acute sense that privacy is really an American value. And it kind of begins around the French and Indian War. You know, the British are trying to find ways to fund the effort. And they issue a series of pronouncements which are supposed to allow British officials to go and look for tax items in people's homes, and unlawful search and seizure becomes part of the colonial anger in the late 18th century. You have the issues of violations of privacy, the Stamp Act, the Quartering Act, all these things that made everyday life something that was increasingly surveilled helped to fan the flames of the revolution. So by the time you get to an independent U.S. in the late 18th century, privacy is really baked into the Constitution in things like the First Amendment, which really does protect our kind of private expressions. You have the Third Amendment protecting our homes from the quartering of soldiers, the Fourth Amendment, which gives people the right to, again, be free of illegal search and seizures. And even now, as we have a lot of debates about the Second Amendment, we tend to go back and read it with an eye toward privacy, as if, you know, we were really concerned about individual right to bear arms, when in fact we know it was really about the right of having a well-regulated militia, you know, state to state. But make no mistake, even with these various pronouncements and the Fourth Amendment or Third or First, it was still very difficult to ensure complete privacy. Even Thomas Jefferson, as late as 1801, basically decided he was going to stop putting political things in letters because his mail was being opened all the time and basically put into the opposing press. So even after the great founding document of the country, privacy was still a hard thing to come by.
So as technology developed, it's easy to forget how monumental and frightening things like photography was when that first came about. Tell us about that.
Yeah. I mean, even worse than photography itself was photography that could quickly be mass circulated through newspapers. And that's, in my opinion, when Americans really begin to get concerned about the kind of right to privacy that we think about today. And it came out of exposing people's peccadilloes, their sexual affairs, their romantic liaisons, and especially American elites, the kind who wrote articles in the Harvard Law Review, began to say, no, we have an absolute right to not be intruded upon by the press. And yeah, it was technology, it was photography, it was the telegraph, it was the constant bombardment to scrutiny, not by the government in this case, but by the press, that really led to the first assertions legally of an absolute right to individual privacy, to not be bothered.
Nathan, how did the issue of privacy intersect with the execution of a war, especially the Second World War?
So if you think about the need to surveil enemy combatants who might infiltrate the United States, you know, you can see that there are a variety of ways that this becomes an issue. Obviously, one of the most, unsavory chapters in American history is the episode of Japanese internment, right? Executive Order 9066, where you see, you know, internment camps of between 110, 120 Japanese Americans in 1942.
This is across the United States you're talking about.
Right. Across the United States, effectively pulling Japanese Americans, again, citizens, off the street in order to keep a closer eye on them, right? Another major project in this period in August of 1945 was called Project Shamrock, and people began to collect telegraphic data entering and exiting the United States. It was a major project that ultimately gave birth to what would be the NSA, but it gave people, you know, access to telegraphs. And again, this is another moment where the technology of communication is seen as a point of concern. So the idea of being able to aggregate, surveil, to confine American citizens, that became a critical piece of expanding surveillance efforts and violations of privacy in the war period.
It was only 3 years ago that the U.S. Army officially stopped putting Social Security numbers on a soldier's dog tag. But Brian, I know the idea of a Social Security dog tag is not restricted to the military.
No, hardly. Perhaps the most popular government program over the last decades of the 20th century is Social Security. But when Social Security was started in 1935, especially those opposed to it said, the government's going to assign you these dog tags. It's just like these authoritarian governments in the Soviet Union and in Nazi Germany. And the Social Security Board itself had actually planned to issue these metal identifiers, and they backed off from that. But there's a really interesting twist that Sarah Igo, a historian at Vanderbilt, tells. It turns out that a lot of Americans, once Social Security was started, they were proud of their Social Security number. There were lots of commercial businesses that manufactured those metal plates, and people paid full retail for them. My favorite story that kind of shows just how much people really identified with their Social Security number is the man who, when asked for his number, would just remove the upper plate of his dentures and hand it to people. Perhaps they didn't touch it, but right there on that denture plate was engraved his Social Security number.
And it wasn't that long ago that when we would cash a check, we'd have to put our Social Security number right on the check for anybody to see.
That's absolutely right. We tend to get inured to what are initially seen as invasions of privacy. And I think that takes us right back to the Facebook story. We voluntarily give up a lot of this information for the sake of convenience. I'm not saying that Facebook shouldn't be more careful with our data, but I think most Americans understand that there are trade-offs involved between convenience and privacy.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. I mean, I think there's a way in which we need to have a certain amount of transparency to show up, say, in a credit report or to show up as belonging to certain kinds of institutions. People need to be able to Google us and locate us in ways that matter. And we oftentimes rely on not so much the government, but on corporations to now protect our identities in ways that is really unprecedented.
When you say not so much the government, even though it might be perpetrating some of the breaches, is the government at all staying ahead of this concern through history and now, or following it?
Well, I mean, it's always the case that concerns about privacy come in the wake of violations of that privacy, right? So there's a kind of cause and effect relationship. But, you know, it is strange to think about now the way in which we still have a very clear sense of suspicion about big institutions. Again, you know, the National Security Agency collecting data. But yet and still, we're very easily going onto, you know, the Apple website, for instance, and providing all kinds of personal information and letting them customize our music lists and so on. So I think, you know, to find an episode like what Brian described in the beginning, where Target has a better sense of, you know, a family's, you know, growth than, say, you know, the father in that very family. That's the kind of thing that really does help to capture where we are right now.
Nathan Connolly and Brian Ballow, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Nice to speak with you both. Thank you.
Great to be here, Lisa.